this was our first laser microscope set up for micro manipulation of cells. This actually, the guy with the glasses is Leon Goldman.
The one in the middle?
The middle one.
Leon Goldman?
Leon Goldman, he was a dermatologist in Cincinnati and is considered the father of laser medicine.
Oh, okay.
He was trying almost everything with any laser and did a few very good things. He was not a very nice man. I have correspondence with him, which he signed Leon Without Gold Man. So this man I've never met later on. I don't even remember where he came from somewhere in California. And that's me.
So a little bit younger there.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, just a little bit younger. And
so you're focusing
the frequency doubled ruby laser with an intermediate optics onto the sample here.
This is
just a photomicroscope.
Mm-hmm.
There's a camera and here's the visual observation. And this a little dim, unfortunately. That was my first laboratory at the GSF with my mechanic and my assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the laser housing I brought from Siemens.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all about 72. I don't know whether that's of interest for you.
I've pulled that out. Yeah.
Okay.
So this is a home, not home built, I guess, but...
the laser was home built,
okay.
As I said, including polishing the ruby rods.
Oh, wow.
That must have
been fun.
Tedious.
Yeah.
And now let's look. We have looked already at the llama pictures. We'll come back to that in a moment. This is not what I wanted. This is already my Münster group, and when we went for a week, we had a seminar and hiking in the Bavarian mountains, and that's in front of the hut where we stayed for that.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to.
So this was all people working in your
Working in my group, yeah. There's, let me see. Oh, Michael had already left at that time. Michael is not on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then this was another mountain hike that the whole group did, and I don't know what year that was, but I would guess the mid-90s or so.
So is this
that's me, yeah.
Is you? Okay.
Yeah, it says the group at work.
Yeah, right. Some Arbeit, I bet.
Yeah. Then this is the prototype of the Llama 1000 that we used to develop all the molding.
Mm.
And this here, 3 years ago, you know the Deutsches Museum in Munich?
Right? Yes.
They opened a new section on nano and biotechnology,
mm-hmm.
and that's what it looks like now in the an exhibition at the Deutsches Museum. I'm a protein analysis.
Mm-hmm.
You can see here. So there will be a few more pictures about that instrument. The after we thought it was only occupying space, but we didn't use it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We were about to dismantle it, and then I got a inquiry from the Academy of Sciences whether they could have it for put it on exhibition in the building,
mm-hmm.
in Düsseldorf, and it stayed there for a few years, and then the Deutsches Museum came,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it was much better to have it there to educate students, the populace. So this was when it was the whole thing was mounted on a huge granite slab. It's very heavy, more than a ton. So there was a special crane that took it out of that building and shipped it to Munich. This is the same instrument again, front view, and that's Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently I took this from slides, 97 is MS. This, we may come back later to the question of the Nobel Prize. This is something that, this slide was made by Cassie Costello on my, this is my birthday cake I was in. And these are several of my students. I mean, this is a group of my students. Actually, I should have also taken that photograph that with Cassie on it. She took it when she was in Münster. And this is Bernd Stahl, this is Kerstin Tuppert, and this is, oh, who is this? Anna Hassenberger. Yeah, and this was another mass spec that we built as a prototype. This is in Japan. This is my wife and me, also around 1995 or so. This is again at the birthday party. Kathy had invited this lady. She plays what's called the glass organ. Have you? Nice birthday cake. And this is
Caprioli.
Yeah, Caprioli and Victor Talros. When we got the Thompson medal at the international conference in Edinburgh. That was it. And then there are some more. Let me see.
Excuse me.
Yeah, I think I sent you the file of the selected publications, right?
Yes.
Yes, you have that, so you can. If you have questions about it, you can ask. And then I have a few. Just photos, digital photos. Let's just quickly go through. This was at the ABRF award. This was Michael again and me. And yeah, same situation. With Utabar is the life companion of Michael, and that's my wife. And then we went skiing afterwards in the Rockies for a week, and had a. And this is another award of bioanalytics that we got. And let me see. Yeah, that's the same. No, that's something else. Let's first get something here. Oh no. I thought I put that in. Maybe there will be one more. This was at a desorption conference in Brazil. Dancing there. Somewhere should be Werner Enns, and there should also be Peter Repstorf. This is in St. Petersburg, that's Mamurin. The reflectron person. And this was when I retired, I sent this picture around. Yeah, that was taken in our seminar room, I don't know when, sometime. It was my birthday, and they gave me this, and then we fixed it up at this column. It's supposed to be a new mass scale. Totally new mass scale.
Oh, okay.
And this is Tanaka.
Uh-huh.
There's another. Yeah. This is also Koichi. That was 3 or 4 years ago. When was it? Oh, six. So, 6 years ago. This picture I was looking for. This is at another award ceremony, and I don't know why what we are laughing at, but something, we were sitting on stage and something was projected, and we found it funny. So I was talking to Michael.
Yes, I like that picture. It's very interesting.
Yeah, right. I like it too. And this is again the Lama 1000 with Michael and me. That was taken 205 or something like that. And this is again one where the, he was transported to Munich. See Deutsches Museum. And this is something. When I was still in Munich, and we were doing this work, among others, on laser safety. One day we got called by some city agency, and they asked us to come over to the Munich Opera House because they were practicing a ballet which they called Laser. So this is the announcement of the ballet, actually. And because the guy from this agency was not sure that the way they were operating the laser was safe. So we went there, and they were in the midst of the rehearsal, and we went into the center, what's it, a loge in English? The place where the king in the old days would sit.
Throne.
What?
Throne?
No. It's a it's a separate place in the on the balcony.
How do you call that? Presidential
suite. Maybe a suite. So we went in there, and we were watching. It was actually Peter Gabel and myself, and we were watching it, and it was immediately clear that they were jeopardizing the dancer's eyesight. But after a while, when we were watching, Peter just, you know, gave me look at the dancer. I said, yeah, why? Well, I said, don't you realize something? He said, no. There's something special about the dancer. I said, no, I don't see anything. He said, I bet he's one-eyed. So it turned out, he had played with a steam engine as a child and lost one eye. And the people as an ophthalmologist saw that. So if and they were chasing this guy with a naked argon laser beam. I mean, one wrong movement and the guy would have been blind. This is something.
But he was able to recognize the fact that
the and then the question was what to do. And we talked to the manager and or how do you call the guy who
producer
yeah, and we said, you know, this is really dangerous, you can't do that, that's too dangerous. And he said, no, but I want to do it. And I said, well, you know, we have to tell the agency that this cannot be done. And he said, well, what do you suggest? And I said, well, they have to, or the dancer has to, after sort of several dancers, they have to wear safety goggles. And he said, no way, no way that they would wear safety goggles. I think maybe you wait, we'll bring some tomorrow and show. And you know, these were the old type goggles, which were really big. And he looked at it and said, oh, this is fantastic.
Yes, I was thinking.
Yeah. Right. So that was about this laser ballet. And this was for my 75th birthday. My students gave me as a gift a parachute jump.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, of course, you do it with an experienced one. It's a duo. And this is when we left the plane.
Good maybe photography.
One more, you see.
Oh, wow.
And there was another parachuter going around us taking pictures.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, and they told me afterwards, they asked me, how old are you? And I said, 75. They said, we have never had a jumper of that age. Actually, I wouldn't want to do it more often because it takes so long to get up there. It's noisy and polluting the air, and then you know, you jump out and the free fall takes just 2 or 3 minutes. Before you can realize what's going on, they have to open the chute. So and you know, my colleague Jasna Peter Katalinic, who actually came out of the door this morning, CNI edited the Maldi book 5 years ago, and we're right now in the midst of editing a second edition, improved edition.
Oh my.
So those are the photographs that I collected.
Oh, they're good.
And we can see later on what to do with it.
Yeah, right? Yeah, they're very good.
Yeah. So, you know, coming back to the development of Maldi, and you know, was it all by chance, or was there some guiding principle behind it? And I think it's important to realize that in the 70s and 80s, biochemistry made huge advances, or in the 60s. Huh? When I started out with my Lama research, it wasn't even known the exact structure of proteins. Were not known. Whether it was a branched polymer or linear polymer, was not known. And during the next three or so decades, it became more and more obvious that biology and biochemistry needed a more sensitive method for analysis that would also allow to give structure information, not just identification, but also structure information. And so there was different work going on in that direction. There were certainly quite a number of people who realized that demand, but not many that really took up work in this direction, and not all of them were really, in the end, very successful. You know, there were static sims developed by Mannhoven here. Then came FAB. Then a Californian fragment plasma desorption, and then one was laser desorption. So. It turned out around mid-80s or so that several methods could, in principle, generate ions of these biomacromolecules, but the quality of the spectra was poor, but more importantly, even the sensitivity wasn't there. Okay. Because if you are in biochemistry or biology, it may take you weeks to isolate a protein out of a tissue or so, and then you wind up with picomoles, and you want to do some functional tests with picomoles, so you can afford only a few femtomoles for the analysis. And so our work was not decoupled or independent of these different activities going on. Actually, as I said, it was known that we needed better methods, but nobody knew how to do it. And certainly there was a common notion that most probably it would be impossible to isolate these huge molecules which were stabilized by their solvation shell out of a biological system or just their aqueous environment and bring them into a vacuum and then on top ionize them and detect them. So there was really great skepticism, and let me put them away. Let me get one of the photos again. I just want to give you a citation of that time. Okay. This was in 86, and it's from a publication of Frank Fields. The mass region of real interest of proteins is 40 to 100,000, and one can only speculate as to whether such monster gaseous ions can be produced. My personal feeling is that to do so may well require discovery of some new technique. So that was a real foresight, And it turned out to be true, of course, for electrostray, which nobody had thought about originally, and it was true for laser desorption as well. Actually, worldwide, there were only three or four groups seriously looking into laser desorption, and we were the only one using UV. All the others used infrared, CO2 lasers mostly, because the idea was you want to do something thermal, and in the infrared you just heat up the raw vibrational transitions in the molecule. From our work in laser medicine, you see, we knew quite a bit about the behavior of these molecules in the UV. So, it was in a way a combination of systematic analysis, because we looked at all the different amino acids, we saw what the difference was in desorption for the different amino acids, but then this observation of the mixture of alanine and tryptophan was that was serendipity, of course.
Yes.
But when it came, we knew how to read it, you know, to interpret it. And
better than the cluster ion in the carbon spectrum.
Yeah, right.
You knew it, how to make sense of what was going on.
Yeah, in this case, we knew what to do and how to make sense of it. Whereas with the Buckminster fullerenes, we had no clue whatsoever, and it just passed by and was lost again. So I think that is important to realize that in a way the time was ripe for some new techniques, and we just lucked out to find the right one. What else did I want to say? A few words more about my relationship with Michael Karas. Of course, first of all, when I hired him, he was recommended by a colleague in Bonn, where Michael had just gotten his PhD, and I absolutely wanted a chemist, because I thought I knew the physics reasonably well, but from school days on, chemistry wasn't my game. So I absolutely wanted someone who was expert in chemistry. And this complementary knowledge and experience was very important. Also, I'm more the person who would do systematic experiments, and Michael is more intuitive. You know, he has some idea, he doesn't know exactly why he thinks it's so, but he would very often be on the right track. Or every once in a while we had to repair the laser. And when I would repair the laser, it would take at least a full day, but then it was perfectly aligned. Michael, and the same was true for Kaufmann, by the way, he would just turn the wheels and the knobs, and it wasn't quite as perfect as my solution, but he did it in an hour. So we were quite different in our attitudes. But the most important thing was that we were both very curious, and we kept debating every day for hours, sometimes very loud, so that our students would think we would jump at each other. And several visitors came to the lab and later on said, you know, we don't understand how you guys can get along with each other. You shout at each other and you never agree on something. In reality, this was the most important feature for the success. Because we didn't, neither he nor I gave up until we had arrived at some solution that we could both live with.
Now, he was junior to you by a number of years in age, right?
Oh, yeah, sure, 20 years.
But I mean, that's not traditional for the junior person to argue with the senior person in this academic realm in Germany, right? I mean, that's unusual. Usually the senior person just says, go away, by
guy. Right, right. At least traditionally, it's not very common in Germany. But I told him at the very beginning, when I hired him, I said, I don't know enough about chemistry that I can give you advice.
Uh-huh.
So you have to be on your own, and I want to learn from you. I'll teach you the laser physics, but I want to learn from you the chemistry. And from the very first day, our relationship was that of two equals.
Okay.
I made a little more money. I had a lifelong position, and he had only a three-year position originally, which was then extended later on. There were some differences, but in the way we dealt with each other, there was absolutely zero difference.
Okay.
And then he left in 98, I think, or so, and immediately got a chair in chemistry at the University of Frankfurt.
Mm-hmm.
So he bypassed, so to speak, the assistant and associate professorship level or so,
mm-hmm.
Because he matured very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so since he's in Frankfurt, we both from time to time call each other, and we miss these debates. It was fun. It was really fun. And, you know, sometimes I was more right, sometimes he was more right. It didn't matter. We wanted
whatever
the best solution
was.
Yeah.
So how many years was it in your collaboration?
Let me check. Yeah, I don't want to give you the wrong numbers. Where is it?
He wasn't with you at Munich, was he, or was he?
He came in 83.
Okay.
Early in 83, and he left in 95.
So he came, so you were in Frankfurt then at the time, when he came.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, when he moved back to Frankfurt, he took the chair of chemistry for the medical students, which was in the same building.
Mm-hmm.
So he returned to the same building.
Mm-hmm.
From 83 to 86, he worked with me in Frankfurt, and then in 86, we both, and Ute Bahr and Bernhard Spengler, we moved here, and he stayed until 95, and then went back to Frankfurt. Yeah, that's right. Sometimes the obvious things you don't think to mention. Okay.
So that collaboration essentially was the continued development, evolution, perfection of MALDI as a tool for the ionization of biological compounds.
He was as important as I was for the original development of MALDI.
Uh-huh.
You know, the looking at the spectra of the amino acids and the dipeptides and so on, that happened while he was already in my group.
Okay.
So I think we both take equal credit for inventing MALDI.
Okay.
And then here in Münster, there was somewhat of a break of our work because we had to transfer the instruments and build them back up again. Mm-hmm. So for a half year, I commuted back and forth. So the work slowed a little bit down around 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Now you look at the list of publications.
Well, looking at at this graph, shows that there was a little dip down there about the time.
I think it's more statistical, to be honest.
Sometimes
happens.
So why did you come to Frankfurt then? I mean, why did you come to Münster from Frankfurt?
Oh, because I was offered the chair and directorship of the Department of Medical Physics and Biophysics.
Okay.
And this was a step ahead in my career,
mm-hmm.
one thing. Secondly, Münster was center of mass spectrometry in Germany because of Benninghoff.
Okay.
And thirdly, my predecessor, the one who had the chair before me, was actually in electron microscopy, but he did a lot of electron microanalysis.
Okay.
So, and he got one of the first prototype LAMA 500 instruments from Leibold that was here already. Ah. So there was some bias for coming to Münster.
Okay.
Because I'm just kind of curious why all of a sudden you ended up going, you know, you left Frankfurt to come here.
Yeah, but...
That means moving all the equipment and...
And several of the people that were in my group.
Did you have problems the school wanted to keep the equipment or, you know, a lot of times there is an issue with who gets to...
Yes, that was a business difficulty. But unfortunately, no, fortunately, the chancellor of the university in Frankfurt, the chancellor in Germany is the main administrator. Mm-hmm. The rector or is the president.
Ah, okay.
So the chancellor, who is of course responsible for the gear and the money and all that, I went to see him and he said, you know, formally, all these instruments belong to the University of Frankfurt. And according to the rules, we would have to offer... We don't know what to do with it anymore, because the one who will take your position in the physics department will do different research. Mm-hmm. But we have to offer it to all other Hassonian universities. And my experience is that they will always find someone who claims the instrument and then they will never use it. So why don't you talk to your colleagues at the physics department and get their consent that you get it as a loan?
Mm.
And that's what happened. So in the Deutsches Museum, actually, where the LAMA 500 now is, it says it's a gift from University of Münster. But in reality, the University of Münster never had a title to that instrument. It is still officially a property of the University of Frankfurt.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's certainly a little bit crazy.
But once again, this person was willing to work with you to have a good outcome.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to...
Right. He was, he was reasonable. He wanted this instrument to be used and not to sit around somewhere.
Yeah.
And there was in the whole state of Estonia nobody who would do even similar work.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, 86, that was before the first publication of a larger protein or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So later on, of course, many people jumped the bandwagon, but not at that time yet, let me say. So what did we do here in Münster?
Mm.
When the whole thing was up and running again, we, first of all, after we discovered the matrix-assisted desorption, we still were working on the project for the National Science Foundation, and we had to produce some systematic results.
Mm-hmm.
They were not interested really in the macromolecular desorption or so. So before I left Frankfurt, the biggest molecule we looked at was melatonin,
mm-hmm.
which is about mass 2,600 or so. And we had already insulin in the fridge,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't get to measure it, as I said, because I was on the run to Münster. And when we were in... when the instruments and Michael and all the others came up here, one of the first things we did was looked at insulin and got results, quite interesting spectrum, almost right away.
Mm-hmm.
Almost right away meant he went down to the laboratory in the morning and around 11 o'clock or so, he came and presented the spectrum. And I have to retrieve that spectrum. I don't remember where I left that. I'm sure I pulled it out. This incident spectrum is very funny because, you know, you have a baseline, mm-hmm. and then the signal goes up, and then there is a spike, and then it slowly comes down. And we published this as insulin spectrum in analytical chemistry sometime later, maybe a year or so later. We were wondering about the spike sitting on this hump, mm-hmm. and we spread the spectrum, and there was a spike, and it was a spike, and it stayed a spike. So it turned out that the spike, which really looked nice as a spectrum, was a noise peak sitting on that hump, which was definitely insulin. Mm-hmm. So it was an insulin spectrum, but that spike there was noise. You know, the electron multiplier sometimes produces noise peaks. Unfortunately, we have lost that original spectrum, because I wanted to go back and show it to someone, and we couldn't find it again. Mm. I hope I can retrieve it later and give you that, because mm-hmm. it's sort of an interesting side aspect. Mm-hmm. And then we submitted an abstract to the Conference of the International Mass Spectrometry Society meeting in Bordeaux in 88. Mm-hmm. And the abstract said something: laser resorption of biomolecules with mass above 10,000. Mm-hmm. And that was submitted, around late in 87 or early in 88, mm-hmm. at least half an hour prior to the conference. And when we presented our results in Bordeaux, we had already a spectrum of mass 160,000. Mm-hmm. You know, it went within a half year. Mm-hmm. We went up from...
insulin's about what?
Insulin and a lot of material prepared and very poor resolution, to something that was much better than that. And excuse me, but it seems I've lost something here in my files.
It's always fun to try and find something that you've lost, that's for sure.
Oh. Can you switch it off for a moment, because I have to take my stick here and see whether... showed how the spectra evolved over that half year, you know. Mm-hmm. And as I said, within a half year, we were up at way above 100,000 in mass, and we went down from 10 picomoles or so to just a few femtomoles. Mm-hmm. And looking back, I think it is clear that while the high mass range was spectacular at that time, mm-hmm. because nobody had believed that one could ever generate ions of that size, mm-hmm. and put them into vacuum and analyze them. But the feature which made it so useful was the sensitivity, mm-hmm. Because that's what biologists needed. And I think it is fair to say that this was the most important aspect of the MALDI mm-hmm. technique. Mm-hmm. At the Bordeaux conference, actually, the next morning after we had presented our results, I was coming to the conference site, and there was Frank Fields sitting having a coffee, mm-hmm. and he called me over and said, you know, you have dropped quite a bomb yesterday. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the acknowledgement after he first said you know, in this publication that it needed a new technique.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately sat down with him, and we agreed that we would start a cooperation. He said, I must try that, we must have that at Rockefeller. And I said, look, you have Brian Triet and Ron Beavis, and I have Michael Karras. Why don't we bring the younger ones together and let them try to find out what can be done. And this is another experience that I would like to share with you, and that is if you're lucky in your professional life, you have a good combination between competition and maybe not necessarily friendship, but good personal relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And we were extremely lucky in our field that we had this combination with X number of groups. And one was Brian and Ron.
Mm-hmm.
And to tell you how that went, then of course the next year, was it next year? I think so. The next year, ASMS. We had a presentation, and by that time, the Rockefeller Group had set up their instrument, and they had some results. And after the session, which was the last one in the afternoon, Brian and I went on a boardwalk.
Mm-hmm.
It was in Miami, I think, and just chatted. You know, what would we think should be done next, and what would be a useful way to go. And we both agreed that it would most probably be advantageous to move from the 266 nanometer wavelengths into the UVA at 355 or 337 nanometers, because there was no absorption of literally any biomolecule, and therefore there would be less fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we discussed that, and we confided to each other that that would be our next goal.
Mm-hmm.
And we also agreed that we weren't sure whether going to longer wavelengths would work at all, but it would be worth a trial. And we also exchanged information that they were looking, or no, they were waiting for the frequency tripler of their YAG laser to get to 355, and we were waiting for our nitrogen laser at 337, and that both they and we had already thought of some matrices. If things would work, then we would try them first.
Mm-hmm.
With these new lasers. Now, ASMS is usually end of May, right? End of May, early in June.
Right.
So we were told by the company that who made the nitrogen laser that there was some delay or so, and it they kept telling us the laser would come in a week or,
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
in a month, and it mm-hmm. didn't come. So by August or so, I was getting nervous because I knew we were in this competition, and I had no idea when they would get their frequency tripler. So I sat down with Ute Bahr, who was operating one of the MALDI machines, and I said, Ute, you know, I know it is. It takes about a week to set the whole thing up, but let's use our excimer pumped dye laser,
mm-hmm.
frequency double it to 337, and see whether we can get spectra. And yeah, it took her about a week to get the whole thing to work, and we got beautiful spectra right away. We first had as a matrix aminobenzoic acid, and that worked so, but then we tried 2,5 DHB, DHB, and that worked very well. And the Rockefeller Group had been thinking of the cinnamic acid derivative.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it turned out we beat them by 2 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.
There was a, in that fall, there was a conference organized by Al Burlingame in San Francisco. And he was there, and I was there, and I presented the results. And he came up to me and said, "Ah, you guys have beat me. We just didn't get our fruited sugar." But, you know, yeah, it was a competition,
mm-hmm.
but it was a friendly competition.
Mm-hmm.
And we have stayed in good contact ever since. In fact, what happened was that they tried the benzoic acid matrix and we tried the cinnamic acid
mm-hmm.
matrix. And they kept claiming this the alpha-cyano-cinnamic acid was better than DHB, and we claimed that DHB was better than alpha cyano.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was, you know, why would that be so? And we didn't know what the reason was. So the next summer, when I went over to Boston, I took some of our matrices, the stuff that we bought from the chemical company. I took them along. I measured the solid state absorption by diffuse reflection in a Beckman spectrophotometer at the Wellman Laboratory. And Brian sent me some of his stuff, and we couldn't see any difference. So at the end of my stay in Boston, I went down to New York, and we just took spectra. And all of a sudden it occurred to both of us, it had nothing to do with the matrix. They were using a linear TOF, and we were using a reflectron TOF. And alpha cyano generates more fragments, it's a hotter matrix, than DHB, and in a reflectron TOF, that's no good because that deteriorates mass resolution. In the linear TOF, you don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
The fragments arrive at the same time as does the parent molecule,
mm-hmm.
and so that was the reason. But you know, we both wanted to know, and a similar situation happened with the Manitoba group, Ken Standing,
mm-hmm.
and Lorenz. We have. I have been there many times, and we did some development, instrumental development together. And at some point, the Manitoba group had published a paper claiming that if you plot the ion yield as a function of fluence, that if the fluence gets too low, there is what they called a precipitous drop of the ion signal. And when I read that paper, I sent them an email and said, can you give me any reason, any physical process that would lead to a full drop-off all of a sudden, as would be true for photoelectrons, you know,
mm-hmm.
that Einstein got the Nobel Prize for anyway. And they said, no, but that's what they observed. And I said, but we don't really see that. So Werner Enns came over here for a couple of weeks, and with his detector, they used ion counting, we used analog signals, and we sorted that out.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he stayed overnight on an air mattress in the laboratory, because at low fluences, it takes you a long time to do ion counting to get a decent signal. So, and the same is also true for Cassie Costello and in the Boston group, and several others in Europe. So, except for one or two exceptions, there was always a fruitful and good exchange of information. At the same time, we did not always disclose to the other group what we were working at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and but it made the research and life very, very pleasant.
So it's like a cooperative competition.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, that's what you might call it. So, what else? Oh, and then already in 88, we started some collaboration with Finnegan Company.
Oh, okay.
And as a result of that, the Vision 2000 instrument was developed and marketed by Finnegan.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
Vision 2000.
Vision, V-I-S.
Yeah.
2000.
Actually, again, this is an interesting story. Because Finnegan had all this experience with ion optics, I mean, they were really masters in ion optics, this Vision 2000 had the best ion optics of any MOLLE instrument I have ever looked at or used. Hmm. At the same time, however, the person that was responsible at Finnegan for this development, Uli Giesmann, he wanted this to be a nice looking instrument, you know, something special, because he said it, even if it performs well, if it looks good, that is very helpful in promotion of the instrument. So it was a reflector instrument, but the linear pass and the reflected pass were both drilled in the same aluminum block, about this size times this size.
Mm-hmm.
And the reflector was sitting at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I must admit, it was a very appealing instrument to just look at. But I had these debates with Uli and said, you know, I'm concerned that everything is so narrow and crammed in. And that makes it look good, but it gives you very little freedom to change things later on if it turns out that changes would be desirable. And it wasn't more than a year after the Vision 2000 instrument was on the market that Marvin Vestal rediscovered the delayed extraction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was already in the very old what are the two guys who built the very first time of flight?
Yeah, I should know the names on the top of my head. Wiley and McLaren.
Yeah, Wiley and McLaren. It was already in their theory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we didn't, we hadn't realized that that was an important option. The reason actually was, and that was also the difference between the instrument that the Rockefeller people built and us, we were coming from the Lama. And in the Lama instrument, because the sample had to be at ground potential, the time of flight tube had to be at high potential, and we never went beyond 3,000 volts, 3 kilovolts, in our time of flights. Whereas the Rockefeller people, they actually used parts that they had already prepared for a plasma desorption instrument, and that was operated at 20 kV. And when Marvin visited the Rockefeller people, and I have to backtrack. Again, you know, this is history.
Right?
Okay, in Bordeaux, we had a fantastic conference dinner at one of these caves, you know, these caves where they keep the Bordeaux wine. And on the way there, I was sitting next to Marvin in the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And Marvin said, really interesting what you have done. I said, yeah, we like it. And he said, do you think it's of commercial value? And I said, Marvin, I'm not sure. If I would be you, I would wait, because you know, the mass resolution isn't as good as one would like it to have, and there are some other open questions. And he said, yeah, that's what I figured as well. So we left it there.
Mm-hmm.
Then after the Rockefeller people had their instrument up and running, Marvin visited them for other reasons, He was visiting Frank Fields, actually, and he saw that and said, oh, this can't be. This is so simple. Mm-hmm. And he was the first one to build a commercial instrument, the Vestek instrument, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what he didn't realize was that it was so important to have a visual observation of the sample, because the samples are very heterogeneous. And us coming from the Lama, the macroscopic arrangement, we knew that visual observation of the sample was very useful. So, you know, everyone comes from a different direction, and then you combine things. And so the Vision 2000 and the Vestek were commercialized about the same time, mm-hmm. and for a while they were the standard instruments that people used until Marvin then sold his company and to ABI and they developed a new instrument. But it's part, you asked me earlier today whether my engineering background was of any use. Mm-hmm. Yes, in these sort of developments together with companies, be it Leibold for the Lama or the Vision 2000 for Finnegan, yes, that was useful. I knew, you know, what are easy ways to mill something or drill something, you know, and until I retired, I never operated a commercial instrument. I mean, the only instruments, commercial instruments, so to speak, that were the prototypes of the Lamas and the Vision, but they were very different from the final mm-hmm. Industrial product. Mm-hmm. So many of the projects that I pursued, or my students pursued, could not have been done on commercial instruments. So we, except for that Vision, we always kept things big mm-hmm. and open so that you could add sure. Things.
Modify it.
Another thing that happened around 1990, I think, was that, when was ASMS in Tucson? Do you remember?
I don't remember, but I can get the date. It probably was
In 89. We had an eczema laser that could also be operated with CO2 gas.
Okay.
And we had tried this laser for desorption, but we couldn't get any spectra. Now, there is something to be learned here. We were convinced that the ionization process in MALDI was photoionization, uh-huh. a two-photon photoionization process. And at the CO2 laser wavelengths, you would have needed something like 30 photons or so in one molecule to mm-hmm. get to the ionization limit. Mm-hmm. And so I was sort of convinced that laser desorption with CO2 lasers would not lead to ions and could not be used for MALDI. But we were still pursuing some laser medical work, so did Kaufmann in Düsseldorf, and he had money for an erbium-YAG laser. Erbium-YAG emits at about 3 micrometer wavelengths. Mm-hmm. And these erbium YAG lasers were very difficult to operate, but I had used one in Boston, so I had some experience with it. And we agreed that the laser would get delivered to Münster, and I would first check it out and get it up and running, and then we would transfer it to Düsseldorf, and then he would use it for other laser medical work. And so the laser came, and I got it up and running, and then I said to one of my students, "Ah, well, you know, let's at least give it one more trial of infrared desorption."
Mm-hmm.
And I had a couple of visitors that morning. I don't remember who it was, and we were sitting in my office and debating. And around 10 o'clock, the student stuck his head through the door and said, "Do you want to see something?" I said, "Yes." And he showed me a beautiful, I think, some protein spectrum. Mm-hmm. He said, "Erbium YAG."
Mm-hmm.
So this remains as a challenge. Are the ionization mechanisms similar or the same for UV or infrared? Are they different? If so, what is the difference? It is still an open question. But it turned out that infrared MALDI works as well as UV. The main difference is that the penetration depth of the radiation into the sample is 10 to 100 times more, and that means you take off per shot about 10 to 100 times more material. And if you have very little sample, then this is not desirable.
But this is still MALDI or matrix.
It's still of course the matrix has to absorb at the laser wavelengths.
Right.
But that is simple in this particular case with the erbium YAG at 3 micrometer. At 3 micrometer is the OH stretch bond, and there's almost no biomolecule which doesn't have hydroxyls or NH also.
Mm-hmm.
And still, the maximum absorption of pure water, which is the strongest absorber at that mm-hmm. wavelength that you can have, is only about a tenth of the UV absorption at all the other matrices. I think infrared MALDI is still interesting from the basic point of view of what are the processes going on.
Mm-hmm.
But for practical purposes, people always use, rightly so, the UV wavelengths.
Mm-hmm.
Something else that we have discussed at times, and which I have no answer to, is 2,5-dehydroxybenzoic acid
mm-hmm.
and alpha-cyanocinnamic acid are by far the most used matrices that still. Now, in the meantime, several groups have taken off looking at other compounds for useful matrices, and I would assume that at least several hundred different compounds have been tested.
I'm sure of that.
Yeah, there are certain special cases. Let's say for synthetic polymers, you would mostly, certainly not alpha cyano, sometimes DHB, sometimes some other matrices. And the same is true for some carbohydrates and so on. But if you ask what is the best universal matrix, so to speak, it is these two. These were the two ones that were first discovered totally independently by two groups not knowing of each other. You know, how and why?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's certainly an interesting question.
Yeah. With good planning or good thought on the selection of the original matrices.
No, I think it was good luck.
No.
To be honest, I think it was good luck because we just went through a server catalog or so and looked for small aromatic molecules mm-hmm. that looked promising. Just this Thursday, one of Michael's students from Frankfurt would come here. He's a very good theoretical and experimental chemist, and he has looked at the proton affinities of different matrices or so. So we have some clue now, at least for DHB, why it is a good matrix, but it's still partly guessing, partly knowing,
mm-hmm.
and still, I think it was luck on both sides. There was something else, by the way, I forgot to mention that earlier. When Brian and I were on that boardwalk in Miami at the ASMS, and we talked about the next steps, and we decided that it would be useful to go to longer wavelengths. We both had that opinion because we felt that if there is no absorption of the biomolecule, there's less fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, photofragmentation, after all, was quite a well-known process in, at that time already. And so that's why we did it. It is not true at all. Now these other wavelengths are more used because it's easier to build lasers for that, for those wavelengths. But certainly the desorption with nicotinic acid at 266 nanometers is softer than even DHB at 337 nanometers. So we did the right thing again for the wrong reason. So in the end, it is always the experiment that wins over. You know,
yeah.
you have to check it out.
Yes.
And if you're lucky, your negative result does you some good. yeah, at the, during those years, then what we did here actually were three major directions of research. Students from chemistry and biology, were biochemistry in particular, were mostly applying MALDI for certain of their projects, or just trying to find out which biological molecules did lend themselves to a MALDI analysis.
Mm.
So, you know, we were the first ones to look at proteins and peptides anyway, but then the first ones to do DNA, the first ones to do carbohydrates, the first ones to do synthetic polymers.
Mm.
None of that we pursued to any extent. We just wanted to know, you know, which group of molecules it was good for, and then we left it to specialists in, let's say, synthetic polymers or so, to pursue it further. So that was one direction. And the other direction was to try to understand the mechanisms
mm-hmm.
that lead to the formation of the MALDI ions. And actually, we were not very successful. And the question is, why is that so? Well, there is a reason for that, I think. And others have tried, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Bob Carter, at,
mm-hmm.
The husband of Catherine Fenselau at Johns Hopkins, and certainly the Manitoba group, and the Brian Child, and Ron Beavis didn't that much, but it did some, and some others, some of the younger mass spectrometrists, looked into the mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it so difficult? Well, if you come to think of it, you generate these ions on a time scale of nanoseconds in volume of nanoliters. And to do good spectroscopy on such samples, you know, like optical spectroscopy,
mm-hmm.
is extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So we made some progress, but not nearly as much as I would have liked to see it or had hoped that we would get it. There's one thing that we did find out about and did sort out was the incorporation of the analyte into the matrix. While we had discovered 2,5-DHB, and Michael and I both, for whatever reason, were visiting Brian Chiat and Ron Beavis at Rockefeller. Mm-hmm. We got a fax from one of my students here, and she had set out to grow larger crystals of matrix, mm-hmm. you know, millimeter-sized crystals. You know, the growing of organic crystals is not easy. Mm-hmm. But she was successful, and she sent us some pictures of that. So that was good. Then we put it into the instrument, came back, we put it in the instrument, and we kept banging the same location for 1,000 times or so, drilling millimeter deep holes into the crystal, and got quite good spectra. Sometimes they got a little weaker, then they came back up again, but clearly there was always some signal, which made us believe that the analytes were really incorporated into the matrix crystals. But couldn't make much sense of it. Then we cleaved the crystals and looked at the cleaved interface and got good spectra. Mm-hmm. So we convinced ourselves that the analyte, the proteins, were sitting in these crystals. At that time, the chemistry department had invited, I don't want to mention the name, very famous German physical chemist, mm-hmm. actually Nobel laureate, who got a Nobel Prize for crystallization. And because I was wondering, you know, whether we were on the right track or so, so I asked the head of chemistry department whether I could sit next to this person during coffee before he gave his lecture. And yeah, he was nice, and I sat next to him, and I told him about our results. And he said, no way, mm-hmm. absolutely no way. These small molecule crystals, they cannot accommodate proteins. Because I told him, we did, of course, crystallography, and it looked absolutely perfect. And I showed him the diffractogram. And he said, no. You physicists, you must be more clean. You're just what you see is just contamination from your sample plate or from wherever. So no. So we, I was a little bit disappointed. He did not convince me. I kept in my presentations wherever. I kept saying we believe that the analyte gets incorporated into these crystals. About maybe now 8 years ago or so, I was scanning literature, and my eye was caught by a title of a paper, and it was, and I don't know why, it was on electron microscopy of sea urchin teeth. Would you believe it? And I thought that was a funny field of research.
Yeah.
So I pulled up the paper and scanned through it. And guess what it said? It said the sea urchin teeth. And meanwhile, I've seen another paper on whale teeth. Mm-hmm. They are calcites.
Okay.
And they are inorganic calcite crystals. And calcite crystallize even in physics, everyone knows, can be very easily cleaved. Mm. So the teeth of the sea urchins and the whales would be very fragile. What holds it together are proteins that are incorporated into these crystals, and they cross the border, you know, uh-huh. these planes in the crystal. Uh-huh. So it tells you that nature is very, very clever.
Okay.
I mean, we ran into that by accident. Nature developed this on purpose, mm-hmm. you know, in evolution. Mm-hmm. I think it's very, very funny. And
I think that's the same mechanism that gets this mother of pearl
feature in the shells is the knacker, or they call it knacker.
Yeah, could be.
Where you get the inorganic crystal type
stuff. Yeah.
But the proteins are incorporated in to make to help make that.
That I haven't come across yet.
If you check in the literature, I think I saw something recently about that.
Could well be. I mean, it's the inorganic factor in organic life.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, if you want to have something very hard, you need inorganic substances. You can't organics. They have all these non-covalent interaction, and you know, the organic world is basically soft.
Yes.
Even polymers
are
whereas. If you want to have something very hard, you better go for the inorganic crystals.
Mm-hmm.
And you also asked, I think, in one of your questions, did we have difficulties to publish things?
Mm.
Yes. It was on and off. We had difficulties early on. We could publish, but not in very high-ranking journals,
mm-hmm.
you know. And
so, what were you trying to publish at that time, in the early?
Well, the first concept of LAMA, for example, mm-hmm. we got into Nature.
Ah,
that was, but that was a real exception.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and but what I wanted to tell you about this incorporation business.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, three separate groups, independent of each other, developed a different method. One is at ETH in Zurich, in Switzerland, at Zenobi. One is at the Max Planck Institute for Polymer Sciences in Mainz, and us. And we figured that sometimes it was advantageous to not mix the analyte solutions and the matrix solutions together, and rather have matrix crystals and then add the analyte solution.
Mm-hmm.
This is, it's not by chance that the Mainz people were after that, because there are so many polymers where you don't have a good solvent.
Mm.
And if you do try to solve them, you extract certain low mass polymers of the distribution, and the bigger ones don't come out. And there are lots of problems with solubility of polymers, and therefore the standard MALDI preparation is not the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question was, can one add, for example, the matrix solution afterwards?
Mm-hmm.
The matrix solution afterwards, and then let it dry. And it works, but it doesn't work nearly as softly as it does when the analyte gets incorporated,
mm-hmm.
when it's sitting at the surface. And also, we found out by using special fluorescence techniques that if the analyte gets only fusisorbed at the face of the crystal, the matrix crystal, then you cannot get any MALDI spectra. No
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
But if it gets chemisorbed, then all of a sudden you get very good spectra, but in this case you get no fluorescence. You know, there are fluorochromes
mm-hmm.
that if they transfer a proton, go from the dark state to the fluorescent state. So we could this way monitor the proton transfer, which is the basic process behind chemisorption
mm-hmm.
between the two phases.
Mm-hmm.
And when we tried to publish that, then we got a very harsh review, and I battled back, of course, and so on. And it went back and forth, I think, three times. And in the end, the reviewer, I think I know who it is, but doesn't matter, the reviewer said, one of our arguments had been that if you take the polymer and the matrix, and then you grind them in a mortar and pestle, or in a ball mill, the longer you grind, or the longer you use the ball mill, the better the spectra get. And I had just written off the top of my head, because it was obvious, that the longer grinding made smaller particles. Smaller particles have a larger surface area per volume, and therefore it's not a surprise that the spectra got better. The reviewer insisted that we provide an electron microscopic picture of a micrograph of 10 minutes grinding and 20 minutes grinding. You know, this was one of the, in the end, more funny arguments by a reviewer. I cannot say that the papers that I think were the most important ones were the easiest to be accepted. Not at all. Mm-hmm. There's no correlation, actually. Mm-hmm. And we kept also having some funding problems. Mm. You know, looking back now, it's all easy, but at times I had to pay my students here. Mm-hmm. It wasn't all that easy, I must admit. We also looked, by the way, at again, as far as the properties goes, an important question of the non-covalent complexes. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of my students got her habilitation with that work. By and large, MALDI is MALDI mass spectrometry on non-covalent complexes is very difficult to do. And one more trivial reason is actually, interestingly enough, in the spectra, the first spectra that Koichi Tanaka published, he used lysozyme, tons of lysozyme, and he claimed he had seen masses above 100,000. In reality, these were non-specific complexes of the lysozymes, you know, lysozyme 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and this is something that is a negative of laser desorption, because you never know whether you have a real biologically important covalent complex or whether it's an unspecific complex formation in the gas phase. Mm-hmm. So, by and large, if someone wants to analyze non-covalent complexes by MALDI, he has to be very careful, or she. It has to be done with great care. You have to add non-specific partners to see how the peaks vary with this addition and things like that. It's difficult. However, in a way, it's also complementary to other techniques, because, for example, protein-protein interaction, which is sometimes difficult by EASY or other techniques, works relatively well in MALDI because you have a large contact phase, usually between the proteins. The interaction between receptor and target molecule is almost impossible to do by MALDI, because during the MALDI process, the proteins no doubt lose some of their quaternary structure, and in this interaction of a receptor ligand, it's usually a very small area where affinity area between the receptor and the ligand, and that easily gets lost in MALDI preparation.
Okay. Yeah.
So, we tried to do as much work as we could on clarifying the mechanisms, but it's still not
but is it, it seems to me that that is a conundrum in all of the newer, like fab. I think there's still a lot of uncertainty as to exactly how that works, and the same with electrospray.
Yeah.
I think that there's at least some debate about the two different thermal mechanisms. For
I think it's clear now that both of them are active, and we have a similar thing in MALDI, by the way, of preformed ions in the matrix crystal already versus protonation in the gas phase, and we had a tremendous, that was really a fight with Richard Knochenmoos, who was started out to work with Renato Zenobi in Zurich, and then left. They couldn't get along with each other, and he kept insisting that it's all gas phase. And Michael had a different hypothesis, and I think we have that we have sort of doubt, seeing that both are active. You know, no one is only right or only wrong, which in nature is not so rare. Situation.
How about, you know, light is a wave and light is a particle.
So we are dealing with very complex systems. You know, a protein is a very, very complex system, and we shouldn't be surprised that the methods that turn out to be successful for their analysis are not simple methods as well. And the notion that you start out with a concept and you develop that concept and you wind up with a perfectly functional system is, in very, very rare cases, it may be right, but mostly it is not.
I think that's what is taught after the fact, when everything has been worked out and you know how to come about, and then you teach it as though it's
it's
a straightforward sentence. When in fact it's a very difficult, torturous path that you have to go through.
Something I also wanted to mention, because it was a question in one of your papers there, was about mentoring students.
Now you have a fairly decent number of students, I would assume.
Right. Well, actually, in Munich I had no students, because it was a national laboratory. Right. In Frankfurt I had relatively few students. Maybe for the 10 years there were a total of 20.
Okay.
Certainly no more than that. But here in Münster I had a pretty large group, as you saw from one of the picture. In Frankfurt, I just didn't have the money to pay them. And things improved here. And I certainly, when you apply for funds, it does matter whether you're a full professor or an associate professor. And the method became popular soon enough so that, that it was somewhat easy to get money. Besides realizing this matrix-assisted desorption, that was truly Michael Karas's and my work. The rest I could not have done without my students. I think I have I was gifted with X number of very, very good students, and I wouldn't want to name any of them especially. Yeah, a few of them did standard work. None of them was lazy, by the way. But it was sort of, you know, I usually came in at 9 in the morning and I left at 10 at night. And there was, certainly in the early days, there was a real enthusiasm in the group about, you know, what could be done and so on. And that transpired to the students. And they were exceptionally good. That's all I can say. And I always try to form subgroups, let's say one biology student, one physics student, one chemistry student. They learned a lot from each other, and I watched that going on, and they had to learn that first time after half year into their thesis work, let's say, they had to give a seminar, and that there would be a discussion, and we would take their hypotheses or results apart. It wasn't easy for them, but at the same time, I think they realized that they had learned something, and I realized that without these students, our work wouldn't have progressed at least nearly as fast as it did, and I'm very indebted to...
So they come primarily from any one discipline to your group? Biology, chemistry, physics, medicine?
You know, that's something that's still typical German. The Department of Medical Physics and Biophysics is part of the medical school. When I came in Frankfurt, I was part of the physics department.
Okay.
And I was a member of the physics department, and I had a secondary membership at the medical school. Because the laboratories were actually located in the medical school and not in the physics department. Here, this department is part of the medical school, and I applied to the physics department for secondary membership, because otherwise I could not mentor PhD students that were physics students, and they declined. I never got that. And despite of Benninghoven, who was very helpful, because then I got stuck, so I needed two mentors from physics, and he was always the one, you know. In reality, I wrote the review, and he just changed a few words and then did it, because I didn't want to put that much of a load on him. But they didn't grant me a secondary membership, and certainly not the chemists and the biologists. So one of my very good students was Bernd Stahl, who did the first work on carbohydrates, actually, on sugars in the milk, actually. And and he finished his PhD, and then there was commencement ceremony, and I went there, and he was there, of course, and he got an award for the best thesis of that year in biology, and then it was mentioned he was the student of Professor X and Professor Y. My name wasn't even mentioned. I didn't care much, except that it was not always easy to recruit students.
So let me get this straight. You got your PhD in statistical communications from an engineering department.
Right.
And you are...
No. My PhD in laser energy measurement.
Laser energy measurement.
Laser energy measurement from an engineering department.
Engineering department. Correct. And so now, when you were at Munster...
No, I was in the physics department in Frankfurt. Yeah.
So now
now Munster, I'm in the medical school.
You're in the medical school.
Right.
So here you are, an engineer in a medical school who cannot get approval from the physics department to...
This is ridiculous.
It's interesting.
Actually... I don't know whether you have read about it. We had this, what's called the Excellence Initiative in Germany. Federal Department has put aside a very decent amount of money, 700 billion euros, to support special research projects at universities, which are interdisciplinary, they must be interdisciplinary, and they must have some new ideas in it. And there were two rounds of requests for proposals. In the first round, we, University of Münster, failed 100%. In the second round, proposal from the medical school, together actually with biology, the two departments together, failed by a very small margin. But we were awarded another project on religion and politics. Münster is traditionally strong in the liberal arts, and this is a fantastic project, really. I mean, there's so much in it. And then there was a third round. It was known there would be a third round, but between the two rounds, there was 5 years in between. So our rector, the president of the university, is a woman. She got together a scientific advisory board with the, not the only, but the main purpose to help come up with proposals for the Excellence Initiative. And I was very strong, and then I'm a member of that committee, and I spent a lot of time in mentoring or counseling or whatever you want to say, of an extended project of what originally was just medicine and biology. It's now medicine, biology, physics, chemistry, and mathematics.
Oh, wow.
And it's called Cells in Motion. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with mass spectrometry, but it has a lot to do with optical spectroscopy and optical techniques, because part of 50% of it is imaging. And of course, in biology and in biological systems, optical imaging, I mean, there's the macro imaging of PET and NMR and so on, but all the micro imaging is optics, actually. And so I'm not part of the group, because I have been retired for 12 years now, but I helped them a lot to formulate it, and it made it. That just happened a couple of weeks ago.
Congratulations.
And it's 40 million euros.
Whoa.
For 5 years.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's very good.
It's big money.
Yeah.
And we are now really looking forward to these projects.
All right. Now, you just mentioned something that's interesting. You've been retired for 10 years. Yeah. Now, is there a mandatory retirement for the academic community here? Or
yes. So? It is age 65.
Okay.
I retired at age 65.
That's all still around.
Yeah, but it's the question of people like me to be around or not.
Okay.
So, now, I mean, I have this position of being member of the advisory committee, which really has adopted a lot of, I wouldn't say power, but involvement in restructuring the university. To, for example, we want to get rid of these strict borders between physics and chemistry and biology and so on, and organize the research more on topics rather than on fields. And you know, that kept me quite busy the last 2-3 years or so.
No, but are you compensated for that, or do you just do that for the goodness of your heart?
Yes, I get compensated for, let me try to remember how much it is. It is 5,000 euros a year. It's peanuts.
Yeah, right.
That's it's peanuts. Sure. No. And actually, there are 3 of the 7 members are now retired. Originally, I was the only retiree, and then 2 more retired during the last 2 years. We do it as a service to our university, and because it's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't think that I could still go down to the laboratory and do experiments. The tactile ability is not there anymore, and maybe the patience or so. I think, and that's also true, by the way, for the Wellman Center in Boston, I think it is much more, much better use of my time if I act as a mentor. And, you know, help people to think things through, formulate, you know, after you have written 20 or 30 or whatever number of proposals, you know a bit about the to-dos and not to-dos.
Yes.
So that's actually my function here. The medical school, as you can imagine, is interested in surgery and maybe oncology, which brings in the big money. They're not interested at all in mass spectrometry. So they couldn't, they didn't replace me by someone else for 7 full years.
Oh, wow.
And that was not good for the field, and was not good for some of the people who stayed, who were younger than I and stayed. My concept when I retired actually was a difference anyway. The department had four professorships. Mm-hmm. My own one, and I was the director, and then there were three associate professors, one in optical spectroscopy, one in electron microscopy, and then Jasna and Peter Katalinic in mass spectrometry of carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. And I thought when I retired that it would be very useful to get together with the physics department and the chemistry department and start a new initiative on structure function analysis. Mm-hmm. And my chair would have gone to crystallization, you know, and there's the accelerator in Hamburg, which mm-hmm. is reachable in 2 hours by train, mm-hmm. Chemistry would contribute the NMR.
Yes.
And then physics and we together would do the mass spectrometry. I couldn't convince enough people that that would be a useful concept. Mm-hmm. I think if we would have been successful with that, we would most probably have been successful already in the first round of the Excellence Initiative, because it's, you know, putting a roof mm-hmm. above all these mm-hmm. Different mm-hmm. Fields, and really those are the methods that keep adding knowledge to our understanding of molecular processes mm-hmm. and so on. So after 7 years, they finally hired someone for optical spectroscopy, and I told you, actually, he's more of a physiologist. Mm-hmm. He works on the brain synapses and does super resolution microscopy. Very good work. I had no objections to hiring in my succession someone who would do something else, mm-hmm. because only when the professorship changes has the university the chance to go from one field to another or add something new. Mm-hmm. But the original arrangement would have been that when Jasna, the mass spectrometrist, would retire, that then they would hire mm-hmm. A mass spectrometrist and build up that group again. It hasn't happened so mm-hmm. far, and I'm not sure it will ever happen. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're now trying to work on a concept where one of my former PhD students, who actually did his work in at Vanderbilt with mm-hmm. the Fiatron laser, and now has a chair for nuclear chemistry in Reading in England, that maybe we can get him back here, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure it will work. Mm-hmm. So
you're retired, but you're not retired.
No, I'm. That's right. Yes, I'm retired.
As Al Neer used to say, his wife accused him, the only thing he retired from was his salary.
Yeah, right.
That's about.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
He went apparently. Well, I knew I interviewed Al Neer many long years ago.
I beg your pardon?
Al Neer.
Yeah, right.
I interviewed him in '89 or whatever. And he said he went in every day, and he retired from, you know, his emeritus, but he went into work every day, every week, and Sundays included. You know. And,
I complained recently to the rector and our dean of the medical school. We were just standing together discussing this and that, and there was some decisions that had been made about a research proposal which was somewhat controversial or so, and I said, you know, actually what you're doing is not right. You have me give my expertise opinion here, and it's open, you know, people know that I was against that proposal for certain reasons, and at the same time I have absolutely no official function in the medical school. Mm-hmm. You know, this is going on a rope without an anise. Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, actually you're right. Yeah. So now they plan to make me senior professor.
Ah, there you go.
So I get a title. But that has to go through the faculty meeting and so on. So it has some official touch to it. Mm-hmm. So maybe sometime in fall, they will appoint me.
But it's obvious you're not ready to, you know, abandon the intellectual.
No, I would get bored.
The activity that's associated with you.
But you know, I don't work nearly as hard anymore as I used to. I told you we have a second home in Munich, and for times we just go there. This summer it didn't work out because my wife has got sick, but otherwise you spend some time down there, and we go to music festivals and go on biking tours.
It's a lovely, lovely city.
Munich is just great, and since I lived there for 15 years,
You go hiking in the Alps and
March it was, we went skiing again. Mm-hmm. For as long as I can think back, 2 weeks of skiing in winter was an absolute must. And I developed this myeloma last summer, and this attacks the bones. Mm-hmm. So the bones get somewhat fragile. And my oncologist said, you know, skiing, I don't know, maybe you should abstain and not go. But I said, but I want to. So they took an MRI of the whole spine. It mainly goes into the vertebrae, the whole spine. And it looked good. You know, there were no fragile pieces or so. But they did not look at my, how do you call these bones here?
Hip bones.
And on day three or so of skiing, it was beautiful weather and great snow, was an Arlberg. And I was standing at the top of a run, and it was looking down, and Ami was behind me. And there was a woman, and she passed by me pretty close. And then she got scared, I guess, because it was steep, and she stumbled and fell and slid down half of that slope or so, but her one ski stayed up there. So just intuitively, as I would always have done, I went over, grabbed the ski to bring it to her, and on the last turn, when I wanted to get to her, my poles, which were just dangling down, caught, one of my skis caught the poles, and I went over a couple of times, and broke two fractures in my pelvic bone. So, if you would have come earlier, then I would have been on crutches. Sometimes you have to pay attention to
what the man says
to age.
Yeah, right.
So I guess my skiing career is over by now.
Yeah.
And I'm so sad about it because I just love it.
I think that comes from, I guess, doing it as a child. Didn't you say you had to ski to school in the winter?
Yeah, and as a student, we didn't have money for any of the lifts or so. So we were going, we were hiking the mountains on skis with skins underneath, you know, seal skins underneath. Mm-hmm. So you could walk up, and then you take the seal skins off, and then you ski down. And I have so good memories of many of these. But all boys ski, and all our grandchildren know how to ski already, except for the two ones in Lyon, which are too small, but two and just born. So, I don't know, this was now more private life, but you can stretch that out.
Well, we'll see, it's up to you. I mean, you'll get a chance to see the transcript.
Yeah.
Of everything that we've said here, and so you can decide what you want to leave in and what you want to take out. But I mean, I think it's part of what we're about is to try and humanize the person and show that they have interests that are greater than their scientific career, and that those interests actually can contribute to their career in ways, and they're more complex than just somebody who did some sterling
Yeah. Okay. Important. Yeah. Important. But we were jumping back and forth quite a bit.
Well, that's okay. Yeah. I mean, it's not supposed to be well super organized. They'll fix it up. They have what I usually will do is have in the beginning a section that summarizes like an abstract and tells the different parts.
But who writes the abstract? They will do that.
They will do the abstract.
Yeah, I think it's good if that is done by someone who is not that involved.
Yeah. So there's actually several oral histories that you can actually look at online that ASMS has on their website. So you can kind of get an idea of how they end up in when they're completed.
Okay.
It'll take some time because all of our conversation is transcribed and then they edit it and look at it to clean it up, and either one or both of us will look at it.
Yeah. So well, I mean, you have seen many of these interviews, mm-hmm. so I would appreciate if you would first go through it and maybe clean it up a little bit here and there. Mm-hmm. For example, I right now remember that I forgot to say within my own professional careers, I made the three of my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
Kaufmann was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Then Reginald Birngruber mm-hmm. is the second one. Actually, he became the director of the Laser Medical Institute of University of Lübeck mm-hmm. and retired last year. So my first grad student already retired. And Michael Karras is number three.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's something important. And if you look at, I can give you a few hints about these names. Klaus Dreisewert is still here. He's in mass spectrometry.
Mm-hmm. At Münster?
He's at Münster. He's still here. And he's publishing quite regularly. And but he's still in mostly in MALDI mechanisms.
Okay.
Huh? Oops.
There are so many different computers and
keyboards. Right. Yeah. Then Reginald Birngruber is in laser medicine.
And do you interact with these individuals?
I mean, I see Klaus almost daily. Michael Karras, we phones from time to time. Reginald actually he's originally from Munich, and he's moving back to Munich, and he's retired, as I told you.
Mm-hmm.
And we share a lot of interest in music.
Yeah.
So, besides laser medicine, of course.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He also spent some time in Boston at the Mass Eye and Ear and at Wellman Laboratory. Kerstin Struppert is one of my very good students. Kerstin is a she. And she is now working for... for Finnegan.
Yeah,
she developed the MALDI source for the Orbitrap.
Oh, okay. So she's fairly young then?
Yeah, well, she's now, let me see, her children are now about 10, 12 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So she would be close to 40.
Okay.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Ute Bahr is the life companion of Michael.
Okay.
And also a chemist. And I hired her when I hired Michael.
Oh, okay.
Actually, I had another opening, and we had a few interviews, and neither Michael nor I were satisfied with the students who were applying for the jobs, for the job, and then one day he came up and said, "You know, I would know something else, but I'm not sure you want to hire her. She's my my life companion,
mm-hmm.
and she is as long as he was with me, she was with me." and she's very good. I mean, she's much more mature, of course, than the other students. She was a PhD also.
So she worked in a lab along with Michael and you?
No, actually, Michael and I saw to it that she was more independent. And that she would neither work for me nor for him. Because, you know, she was a postdoc, anyway. She had worked for the industry before. Okay, Peter Gabel is the ophthalmologist, as he's not there, and he's also a very good friend by now. He has just recently moved back to Munich.
Everybody's going back to Munich.
Yeah, well, you know, this was our laser gang at that time. Raymond Kaufmann, also a very good friend. He unfortunately died in 98, sorry, of brain tumor.
So he's the kind of kind of got you started a little bit.
Yeah, in a way, because he had the right problem to
for which you had a tool.
Right, I had the tool. And yeah, certainly he was very important in that phase of my life.
So a chance meeting at a party.
Yeah. the sort of final concept of the Lama we developed in a public pool. It was summer like today, it was a lot of sun. And we went there and we lay on the floor on the lawn and scribbled things down. He was a very unusual man, an incredible womanizer.
Oh, really?
Incredible womanizer. And he was also married then, and had a daughter, but that didn't keep him from chasing, or we would say he was chasing every apron. But he was very good. His father actually, that's interesting, his father was a professor of physics in Freiburg, and his father had done an experiment, an early experiment that was actually is now considered the earliest proof of Einstein's theory of relativity.
Oh, wow.
But he was a very conservative man, apparently. I never met him, he was long dead because Raymond was a very late child of his. And he spent the rest of his life trying to find a classical explanation to that experiment, and had huge controversies with Einstein. And Raymond had a letter from Max Planck. And Max Planck was then president of the German Physical Society, and Max Planck was then called Emperor Wilhelm Society. And apparently Kaufmann had written him a letter that he was annoyed about this Einstein with his strange theory of relativity and so on. And the letter by Max Planck reads about, you know, I have my reservations about Einstein's theory as well, but I would recommend to you to be a little bit more careful with your arguments, because he is really a very bright guy.
Oh, wow. You know, there's this old tradition in the German physics community that if you can't demonstrate it with an experiment, you know, the theoretical stuff is okay, but if you can't demonstrate it with an experiment, then it's no good for anything. You know, I mean, it has to be experimentally based, and so...
And you don't think that's right?
Well... but I mean, the whole idea of any theoretical thought was just, you know,
okay.
Pure speculation.
You should not stand up and say this is all nonsense, and because there is no experiment.
There hasn't been an experiment before.
But it should be a challenge for the experimental physicists to do the experiment, and the best example is the recent last muon that they... not muon, what was it?
Large Hadron Collider.
Right, in CERN. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it took billions of dollars and hundreds and hundreds of researchers to hopefully finally prove that the Higgs particle. And Higgs is still alive. I don't know whether you knew that.
I think
he went to the ceremony when they presented the results to the public. I think that's fantastic, you know, if you...
So they really think they found it, because it seems like they've only gotten evidence for like two or three, my understanding is they really have only
I think
evidence.
They say the uncertainty about the evaluation of all these detector signals is less than 1% or so.
Okay.
But there is a little doubt left. But the main doubt came from the people in Chicago, I think it is, right? Because they had claimed the Higgs particle once before, and it was clearly shown that it wasn't. So there is a real tough competition. But there's a lot of money involved. So, that was it. Stefan Bergenkamp is one of my grad students, and he's also a very good student, very unusual. What did you say about Graham Cooks? He's
crazy.
To some extent, Stefan is crazy. He was brought up in a very liberal school, and he only does what he wants to do. But he and Finn Kirpekar, which here it is, they found out that with glycerol as a matrix in infrared desorption, you can get ions of several hundred thousand Dalton of DNA.
Glycerol with infrared.
With infrared, right. But with UV, you know, typically you can analyze a 50-mer as a maximum. Which is 15 kilodalton. But with infrared MALDI and the erbium-YAG and glycerol as a matrix, they went up to 250,000 or so. And again, it's sort of a mystery why this is so. That made it into science. That was a science paper. And he was very proud, of course, as a grad student to be first author on a science paper.
Oh, sure.
And
a lot of people would love to be on science papers.
And he is now the mass spectrometrist at a company in San Diego called Sigmenome. Sigmenome, like sequence. Sigmenome, right. And they are the only company actually that market MALDI mass spectrometer for DNA analysis, mainly SNP analysis. And he actually designed and supervised the construction of a relatively simple and cheap mass spectrometer for these applications. The company actually now is off to something else. They thought they could use MALDI to analyze the DNA in the bloodstream of the mother, child DNA, and be able to show whether or not there was some genetic disorder. And it turned out that MALDI was good enough for about 80% of all samples, but the rest of the 20 samples, there was not a clear answer, and that was you can't market a system like that. So they do now do it by regular sequencing, and it's an ethical question now, and it's not clear whether that will be allowed to be done in many countries. In Germany, for example, there are strong resentments because they essentially, now that they, you know, when they tried to do it by molding, they had to choose maybe 20 or 30 SNPs, mm-hmm. and they would look only at these SNPs, mm-hmm. and that the only information they would get would be what the distribution of these SNPs were, you know, the single nucleotide polymorphism, and then they could conclude back on trisomy as a genetic disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Now that they go to sequencing, they can essentially sequence the whole genome of the baby.
Mm-hmm.
Of the, so they could certainly easily find out whether it's a boy or a girl early on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole thing happens during the first few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So they still market these instruments for other applications, and that is MALDI. So it's another company that is in the MALDI business. Rainer Nietzsche was actually a grad student of Kaufmann and myself in the LAMA development.
Oops.
And at some time, the Heraeus company, not Laboratories, but Heraeus, went into the business of medical lasers. And he worked for Heraeus to develop and market mainly infrared lasers for laser surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where he is now.
Okay. Here you have a laser following up on lasers. Here you have a fellow that's following up on MS.
Yeah.
MALDI, eye doctor, chemist, following up on MALDI.
You know what? If you reorder that, bring Kaufmann up to the top, above Michael.
Where is Kaufmann? Here he is. See if I can grab him here.
Yeah. That will make things a little easier. Okay, then bring Rainer Nietzsche up there, right below Kaufmann.
Oops. Hey, wrong button.
Okay, then who else is here? Bring Gabel up.
Okay.
And we will reorder Birngruber below Gabel.
Let me put this guy back.
Yeah. Okay, now. Then Wexung under Nietzsche. Okay, then there was another other side where there was Vogt. Above Gabel. No. Okay.
Let me put this guy.
Okay, now let's look at the other side whether there is someone else I would. Oh, where do we put Giesmann? Let's leave it there at the moment. Let's go back up again here. All right, now, these are the LAMA people. And Wexung and Vogt are the. Wexung was the head of the development section of Leibold Heraeus. So he was essentially responsible for the design and construction of the LAMA instruments.
AEUS, right?
Right. And Vogt was, he worked for him. Warwick soon. Nietzsche was formerly a grad student of Kaufmann, because Kaufmann at that time was already professor and I wasn't. But Nietzsche actually worked in my laboratory, mm-hmm. and because Kaufmann was first in Freiburg and then in Düsseldorf, so he only came to visit once in a while.
So these...
So Kaufmann, Nietzsche, and... Where's Wechsung? Okay, and Vogt. So right. these are the Lama people.
Right.
And maybe you put a blank line in between.
Let me do a... I'll make those guys red. And... why don't I go up here and say Lama people?
All right. Then these are the ophthalmology people. You know, that started out as laser interaction in the eye, and then went on to other organs.
Okay.
Ophthalmology people in Munich.
Okay,
so then after that, I think Michael Karras, the rest are all MALDI.
Okay, so just these two are the ophthalmology?
Or? Oh, there were more people, but those represent the group quite well.
Okay. So from here on, it's MALDI.
I think MALDI, yeah. Okay, so let's go. We talked about Kerstin. Mm-hmm. Ute Bauer, we talked about Stefan. We were there just when we left. Yeah. So he did essentially the infrared MALDI of DNA.
So this is Stefan?
Stefan, yeah.
Okay. Infrared MALDI of DNA.
There you go. Okay. I don't know where the laser surgery went, where that was.
Grad student, South Director, C. Fenborough, published in Science MS, Sequenome.
Yeah,
that
would belong.
DNA analysis, and it probably goes to the eyeball people, right?
Yeah.
Recently retired, he's a very good friend. Okay.
Yeah, here you can see, laser medicine in general. Okay. Now, Eki Nordhoff did the early work on sequencing of peptides and DNA. So he was my... the rest are... I think all of them are my grad students.
Mm-hmm.
Or postdocs. Okay. Bernd Stahl was a biology student, and he did the first work on carbohydrates. Arndt Ingendoll was a physics student, and he did quite a bit of instrument development. He optimized the reflectron, for example, for our purposes. Okay. Stephanie Hahner, let me just see. He works now for a company that the name of which I don't know, because there have been too many changes,
mm-hmm.
Of names and being bought up. It's a food company, and they make baby food. So, and he says the carbohydrates are actually milk sugars.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the world's expert, I think, on milk sugars as ingredients in baby food.
In baby food, in mother's milk.
An interesting observation there, by the way, when Germany got reunited in 89, mm-hmm. It turned out that for whatever reason, the government in East Germany had accumulated a huge amount of human milk. So, and his company bought that up. And it was, of course, dried, you know. Mm-hmm. You know? So his company became aware of it and bought it, and he analyzed that all, and that went into the recipes of the baby food, because the carbohydrates in human milk have a very strong immunologic function, and so he's the and he did it all by Molly. So
why would they do the baby mother's milk?
I don't remember why they did it, but I guess, you know, their social system was such that babies were taken away from the mother at an early, very early age, mm-hmm. and the mothers would just pump off the milk and then give it to the organization which took care of the children, and like kindergartens were very small ones, and obviously that was surplus.
Mm. So there was a separation of the infants from the mothers in East Germany?
Not always and not necessarily, but the communist system, certainly part of it was that the children should be educated not by the parents, but by the society.
Ah.
And first of all, and they had solved the gender issue much earlier than we even became aware of it, that is, women should work.
Ah.
And even
so, they have no responsibility to have the child.
Right. Even if they were not productive with what they did, they had to work. So it must have something to do with it. I don't know. And I just know that there was all this human milk. So Stephanie Hahner did the late work on DNA analysis. And maybe, yeah, okay. And she worked for Bruker until not so long ago, and then she got a child, and I don't know exactly where she is now, but she was in Bremen.
Ah, okay.
But I should, at this point in time, and when you reshuffle the whole thing, you may move that forward, I should say that during the years here in Münster, I did not do much work, or my group did not do much work, on proteins and peptides, because everyone jumped on that field, and I thought that wasn't interesting enough. Mm-hmm. And we concentrated on nucleic acids, DNA and RNA.
Mm-hmm.
And
which I think are more difficult, aren't they?
Yeah, they are substantially more difficult. And for a very simple reason, if you think of the double helix, okay, you have these phosphate groups, and then you have the sugar ring, and then you have the base.
Mm-hmm.
And in under natural conditions, the proton of the phosphate group jumps over to the base if the base is a base. At least temporarily, it resides with the base.
Mm-hmm.
And if the base on the top nitrogen is protonated, that draws electrons from the N-glycosidic bond, and the base falls off.
Mm-hmm.
And once the base falls off, you have an asymmetric molecule, and it just falls apart. So part of Julia Gross's work was exactly to clarify that mechanism, because I had discussed it with Michael Gross. They have nothing to do with each other, they're not relatives, even though they have the same name. We did, Julia did a lot of HD exchange experiments to prove where the protons were going or coming from. And so that's why DNA is so much more difficult. And actually, Stephanie Hahner's work, we were just at her name here, was to see whether one could derivatize DNA to stabilize the N-glycosidic bond. For example, by replacing the hydrogen in RNA by fluorine in the two prime position. The basic result of her work was summarized to say that yes, this can be done, and then it's good for mass spectrometry, but all the enzymatic chemistry which precedes the MALDI analysis doesn't work well. These enzymes, they just don't like a fluorine or an CH3 in that position. So that was Stephanie Hahner. Finn Kirpekar was a postdoc from Peter Repsol's group. No, from Peter Repsol. He came here for a year as a postdoc, and he had gotten his PhD from Peter, or a colleague from Peter, who was in DNA. Peter was always in proteins.
Did I get that spelling okay?
Ørsted is okay. It's okay. You could also write University of Southern Denmark or Odense. Okay. And here I made a mistake. You see, Eberhard Unseld is a Lama man.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so we have to move him up.
All right, we'll do that.
And he was a postdoc.
So let's get him here.
Oh, no, no, these are the company people. Put him up here because he was like Nietzsche, you know. He was actually my postdoc in Frankfurt. Okay, and actually his father was a very famous physicist, and there was a question of whether he should have gotten the Nobel Prize for the cycle, energy cycle in the sun.
Ah.
He wrote very early a very famous book, Physics of the Stars. And he was made full professor at age of 25, and he lived to celebrate his 50th anniversary as a full professor.
Wow.
Yeah. I met him a couple of times. Very interesting man. Okay, so let's go down here. Christian Lüdemann did, he actually did almost all his PhD work in Boston, but on MALDI. And he proved experimentally. I have to go backtrack a little bit and tell you a little bit more about the ionization mechanism. The quantum energy of a photon at 337 nanometers or 355 or so is less than half the ionization potential of any of the peptides or proteins or any of the biological molecules. So with one photon you cannot generate ions.
What was the 350 nanometers?
It's about 3.5 or so EV. Okay. I don't remember the numbers. Okay. It's too long that I have been kicking these numbers around. But it's about...
It's not enough. One photon is not enough to get the job done.
Not even enough for half of it.
Okay.
Okay. And of course, in lasers, you can drive the laser irradiance to a point where a molecule is already in the excited states, absorbs the second photon resonantly, and goes, and then you have the energy of two photons, and with a little bit of help by thermal energy or so, that could be enough for the ionization. But if you calculate that, and that was in one of my early papers already, you find out that there is not enough photons in the beam. If you have enough photons for a sizable excited state absorption, then you destroy your sample. You know, we discussed before that you have to be very careful to not exceed a certain limiting laser influence or laser irradiance. So that doesn't work. And we then postulated in an early paper that there are mobile excitons in these crystals. That is, you have an excited state of one, let's say, DHB molecule. And this excitation energy can migrate through the crystal.
Excitons.
Excitons, yeah, they're called excitons, the excited molecules.
Like a phonon?
Yeah, it's a little bit like a phonon. But it's much higher energy, you know, it's UV. Phonons are usually lower energy.
Yeah, okay. So it's a hot phonon.
Yeah, it's, they're called excitons.
Okay, excitons.
So they're mobile excitons, and the notion was that two excitons would combine in one place, and one molecule would go up to the to twice the energy, and the other one would fall down to the ground state. Okay, and this is we didn't invent this idea because that the physicists knew about excitons and about Frankel excitons, which are localized and non-localized or mobile excitons. So you can take that from a book in solid state physics. Okay. So we postulated that that was the mechanism.
You got one photon, but with the excitons in there that.
Well, one photon gets absorbed, so it turns the molecule that absorbs it into an exciton, into an excited molecule. Okay, and then it passes its energy to the neighboring molecule, and then on and on and on. It's like in semiconductors. The excitation energy jumps, and this can happen at some reasonable efficiency only if it's a well-ordered crystal. In amorphous systems, this is not very probable. At any rate, you can predict if that's a mechanism, that if you look at the fluorescent yield, of course all these molecules have low but have some fluorescence, if you plot the fluorescent yield as a function of the laser fluence, then you lose at higher fluences, you lose some of the fluorescence. In other words, when you start at very low fluence and you begin to increase, the fluence increases in proportion to the excitation. The more photons you put in, the more photons you get out. But then all of a sudden this curve levels off. Because the photons are not available anymore for fluorescence, or the excitons for fluorescence, but they go into an ionization process. So that's a different process, and further on. So and that is a very tricky, are very tricky experiments to be done. And Christian Ludemann did that in Boston, exciton migration.
Low energy photons.
Yeah. Okay. And after he finished his PhD, he went to Harvard Business School and he's working for a bank now.
Oh.
But when I last saw him, he said it was so boring and he wants to go back to physics.
I have a friend of mine who did that. He was in science, got his MBA.
Oh, yeah, okay.
He makes a ton of more, much money.
Yeah, of course you make much more money.
You have to come out of your ears, you know.
Right.
All right.
Right. Christoph Menzel did also the much of the design work in infrared molding. And he's now working for Qiagen. I think that's right, I have to check it, but I think that's okay, which is a company that makes assays for medicine and for chemistry and so on. So even though he was a physicist, he went off to chemistry.
He was a deserter.
Yeah. And Martin Schoenberg is another interesting, he was also one of my grad students. He is my nephew, actually. He's the son of my sister.
Mm-hmm.
And he absolutely wanted to do graduate work in laser medicine.
Mm.
And he came here and I said, okay, if that's what you want, we can try it, but I don't have good partners
mm-hmm.
for medical laser work here in Munster. The good partners I have are all in Boston,
mm-hmm.
and he was already married and had a child, so he it would have been very difficult for him to go to Boston. So he started a project on laser surgery here, but after about a year, it was clear it wasn't going to work. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't getting him anywhere. So I had a long discussion with him and said, look, I can, you see the others doing the work on the MALDI, that's a sure thing. I mean, if you do good work, then you can certainly get your PhD for that. And why don't you switch?
Mm-hmm.
So he switched, and he worked pretty closely with Klaus Dreisebert, who mm-hmm. is up on the list. Mm-hmm. And then Klaus Dreisebert got his PhD, and Martin hadn't gotten good results yet,
mm.
so he was about to quit. And because I had asked him to see whether one could also do MALDI with wavelengths in the visible.
Mm-hmm.
Other people had tried that and had claimed some success, but I was not sure that those were real results. And but I told him, you know, it may well be that it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't, you can get a PhD no matter whether it works or doesn't work. But you have to make good experiments and prove.
One way or the other.
So he was at that point in time somewhat desperate. And then we changed the topic a little bit around, and within a half year, he had tons of results.
Mm.
Really very good results. He, for example, showed that you could irradiate the sample from behind and still get good ion signals.
Hmm.
And what else, actually, now I'm...
But this is using
UV MALDI.
UV MALDI. I thought we'd start out invisible, but the visible...
Yeah. Those experiments were done pretty soon. He was done with them, and it was clear we did not find any molecule that would work as a matrix indivisible. This question isn't finally answered yet.
Mm.
And in fact, I hope that Klaus Dreisebert, together with the student from Michael, who will be coming up on Thursday, that they will use their OPO laser
mm-hmm.
to go from the UV continuously into the visible and see what happens there. Mm-hmm. My suspicion is that one can get it to work in the visible and will be similar to infrared molding,
mm-hmm.
less sensitive, but we don't know yet. So he could not find any matrix that would give results anywhere nearly as good as in infrared or UV, and mm-hmm. then we gave that up. But I then put him to something else, and that was, are you familiar with Tanaka's work?
Yes, a little bit.
Okay, so in the Tanaka system, you have glycerol, like in FAB,
right.
and you use metal particles
right. mm-hmm.
That are suspended in there, and in our likelihood, the ionization process is similar to FAB,
mm-hmm.
okay? And it's thermal, but it's modulated by the glycerol, which takes away from the molecule some of the thermal energy. And the question was, can one prove this as a system? And Martin looked at about a dozen different particles, carbon, metal particles, polymer particles, which were covered with some fluorescence molecules and so on. And in particular, looked at the results as a function of the particle size.
Mm.
And it is absolutely clear if you have particles that are small enough that the laser beam will penetrate them and do a bulk heating of the particle, this is very different from the situation when you have a larger particle and the laser radiation penetrates only a superficial layer and you get a lot of cooling, mm-hmm. immediate cooling to the surrounding.
Mm-hmm.
That was also published, I think, in Analytical Chemistry, and it's a very nice paper because it really proves what the mechanisms are.
Mm-hmm. So this is, you followed up on Tanaka's.
Yeah. Well, you see, Tanaka never did any systematic work or so.
Yeah.
In fact, he never used it.
Yeah. Well, did anybody else?
No. No, I mean, I visited him in his laboratories using molding,
mm-hmm.
or electrospray. What?
Peter Ulrich?
No, Peter. What? Was there only Peter Rebsdorf, or what's Ulrich Peter here?
That's Peter Ulrich. I got the names, but I don't know. There's the.
No, there was Ulrich Giesmann, I think.
There
was Giesmann.
Is that right?
Yeah. Double N.
Double N.
Yeah. Okay. Giesmann was the head of development at Finnegan for the Vision 2000. So it's MALDI.
V-I-S-I-O-N 2000.
Yeah. And at some point in time, Finnegan decided to not make any MALDI mass spectrometers anymore. And then he moved on to some other company, and he's now with Bruker in Billerica.
That's in Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, right. It's close to Boston.
Okay, and then Peter Rebsdorf.
Okay, both Giesmann and Peter Rebsdorf are good friends.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
At some point in time, Peter and I had a joint project on DNA analysis, actually financed by the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
Peter is just a great guy.
That kind of gets a rough idea of how these various characters fit into your research environment, which I think is a good thing. Because I mean, this list was derived primarily by my search of the SciFinder to how many different people you had published many papers with. So there had to be colleagues.
The list is not complete, but I don't think that needs to be. Yeah.
No, I know there's many more.
It goes
on forever.
Yeah.
I think I've got the complete list here somewhere, but
no, this is okay.
Yeah.
In one of your emails, you also said you wanted to talk a little bit about patents.
Yeah.
And IP.
Yeah.
That is not a simple topic. First of all, I must tell you that until shortly after I retired, there was a law in Germany that professors at a university, and it was a privilege of only professors at the university, only full professors at a university, would have the full rights to their patents.
Oh, wow.
So the patent was not owned by the university, but it was owned by the professor.
But I mean, if you weren't a full professor, the university owned it.
Yes.
And you had nothing. I mean.
No. If there was some revenue coming from the patents, then the university would have to share that with the inventors, the percentage was, you know, there was a long list of criteria. Like in the U.S., it's very, very similar. The professor who had a life position. So in Frankfurt, I was already owning my own IP, and in Munster as well. At the National Laboratory, the laboratory owned it. But when I left the laboratory for Frankfurt, sort of a compensation for the fact that I had been treated very poorly by the head of my department, they gave me the title to the patents that I had filed before I left for Frankfurt.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds great, but in reality, it mostly prevented IP from being patented at all, because you know, in the old days, you would at most file for as a German professor file for a patent in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, if you want to get anything out of it, you have to file for patents at least in Europe, in the U.S., in Japan. Now, I guess China. Yeah, and this gets so outrageously expensive that most of the IP never made it to a patent. While I was at the National Laboratory, they had a patent lawyer, and he did most of the work, and the National Laboratory paid for the patent, for the early patents, let's say. They never made any revenue, so they lost. They didn't lose much money either. They were only German patents. And when we began with Raymond Kaufmann, he was also a very clever businessman. When we began the work on the llama, we immediately filed, before we published, we filed a couple of patents. And we filed them in Germany first, and then we began to talk to Leibold Herreus about building these instruments. So they took them over, and they saw to it that there were international patents. There's about a half dozen patents on the way you arrange the laser and in what fluence range you work. And I learned a lot. What's important in a patent to make it difficult to get around the patent. For these about 50 to 70, I don't remember the number of llama instruments that Leibold sold, mm-hmm. they paid us revenue fee. And I don't remember how much money we made, because that was never part of my personal income. You know, I used it, for example, I was not permitted to send students to conferences.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a full-time position, so they couldn't get refunded for the travel expenses. So I always paid their, let's say in Bordeaux, I think there were 12 of us. So,
okay.
Because, you know, we really wanted to
sure.
to see people get excited about it. And I paid for almost all of that, those travel expenses. But, you know, it was, it didn't make us rich, but it was sizable money. It was something like half a million Deutsche Marks or so,
mm-hmm.
altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But it was split, actually, between Raymond Kaufmann and Ebert Unsold and Naya Nietzsche and myself.
Mm-hmm.
So there were already four.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when we started the Maldi development and started to work with Finnegan,
mm-hmm.
We made a different arrangement. And I said, you know, even if by that time the university would have supported me with the patenting procedure,
mm-hmm.
but I said, even if that would happen, the likelihood that the university can find a company that would use the patent is relatively low.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the patent and IP offices in Boston that I have been dealing with, particularly Mass General Hospital,
mm-hmm.
they are extremely good now. They make a lot of money out of their patents.
Mm-hmm.
But they are pros.
Oh, yeah.
And that was not the case here. And I said, well, on the one hand, all this research that resulted in this IP was paid for by public money,
yeah.
was tax money.
Mm-hmm.
So actually the patent, if you have a patent, would belong to all of society.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, and then the patent isn't very useful. On the other hand, if you have something good and it's not patented, you won't find a company to take it over,
mm-hmm.
because they wouldn't have any protection.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that the most reasonable thing would be that Finnegan would file the patents, but would name us as the inventors. And we had a license agreement with Finnegan, which said that they would pay us royalties. And a certain amount, 3% of the sales price or something like that. And importantly, later it turned out, it had a paragraph saying that if they would stop selling Maldi instruments, the patents with all the rights and without any fee would go back to us.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like a good arrangement. For the reasons we discussed before, the Vision instrument wasn't a great success because, I think we got off that topic by the way, but let me then put it in here. For the reason that this delayed extraction, which tremendously increases the mass resolution at the time of light mass spectrometer, this works only at high aspiration potentials. Down at 3,000 kV, you can hardly pick it up. And we had only instruments with 3 kV, so was the Vision instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And because everything was so narrow built in, even with we had then Teflon sheets wrapped around the reflectron or so, we always got sparking. So there was no way, and the same happened in the ion source. You know, if you have potential differences of 10 kV between different electrodes, that's not a simple thing to do.
Yeah, that can be...
Yeah, so all attempts to bring that up to speed didn't work, and therefore Finnegan didn't sell many of them, so we got a relatively small amount of royalties, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rights of the patents should have come back to us. But that requires a change in the patent role of the patent office in every country that you have filed a patent for. And Finnegan just didn't do it. You know, and can you, yeah, of course you could take a company like Finnegan to court, but, you know, I would be a very poor man before I got anywhere. So they sat on the patent until about 10 years ago, and by the time they gave them back to us, actually what happened was someone in the development of quadrupole mass specs in San Diego, not San Diego, in California, Finnegan there, he also was involved in trying whether these instruments could be used with MALDI, which they did actually. They developed a source for that. And later he became chief of development at Finnegan. And I met him at the Linux MS. And I complained. I said, look, this is really not fair. Because you know exactly how things went. And there is, okay, he said, I'll look into it. And a couple of weeks later he came to Germany. So he visited me in my office and we struck a deal that they would be allowed to use these patents without any royalties in the future if they wanted, but the patents would go back to us. But at that time, they were almost expired. So we really didn't make any sizable money with our MALDI patents. Actually, we had foreseen, when we filed the patent, we had foreseen that there might be something infrared. So it said every wavelength longer than 300 nanometers. So it wasn't a bad patent, but we didn't get anything out of it. I think that for the acceptance of MALDI as an analytical technique, this was good. Because there wasn't a single company that could dominate the field. In fact, before Martin Vestal started to build his Vestec instrument, he called me and said, do you have a patent that can keep me from marketing such an instrument? And I said, no, you can go ahead. So, for the distribution of the technique, it was good. We could have made some more money, but I could have stayed with Siemens to begin with.
If you wanted to make money.
I never regretted this, I must say.
So you've had at least had a lot of experience with patents.
And I find it very hard to spend the time writing patents or just reading them, correcting mistakes that the patent lawyer makes. It is. It has never been one of my favorite jobs. And particularly now with Sikrino, they have a lot of patents, and I'm on some of them. And in this field, and maybe it's not only in this field, patents have something like 200 claims or so. It's awful. It's awful. So I think there is no golden rule how to go about it.
I think it's a lot of work for any person, and a few, a very small number, actually benefit to a large degree. That's the sense that I've gotten. But for most people, it's just really not worth the effort.
I would agree with that.
The problem is you don't know which is going to be the one that turns, into the big producer of gold.
So. But to the best of my knowledge, almost no university, now that in Germany and the US that they own the patents, make a break even between the people they employ to take care of the patents and the royalties they have as an income. On the other hand, I mean, it is a valid argument that if you want something important for society, to be available to society, you have to find a commercial partner, and a commercial partner needs protection. So it's not just that people are after the money. That's the way, at least, I rationalize that even though all the money I ever had from my research was tax money, that I did give something back to society by inventing a method that was useful.
Very useful. I think everyone was pretty much in agreement with that. I don't know...
is there anything else that we...
Well, I think we've covered everything on my list. I mean, we've talked about quite a bit of this, you know, funding issues, and talked about a lot of your collaborators. Obviously, I think, it's my impression, and I don't know how you feel about this, but it's my impression that many people in the mass spec community feel that that the work that was done for MALDI was more, how would I say, should have been more recognized by the Nobel Committee than the work that was done by Tanaka.
I mean, this is, of course, a difficult issue, and I forgot about it. We mentioned Tanaka one or two times. And let me first of all say, Tanaka and I are not friends, but we are colleagues that respect each other, and certainly the decision of the Nobel Committee wasn't Tanaka's fault.
No.
We just were lucky enough to be considered. That's number one. Number two, it is true for publications and research proposals as well. There's a certain point to which you can drive your own work and be responsible for the negatives and the positives of it. With other words, to be considered by the Nobel Committee, and I know that we were in the game, of course, that is a fruit of our work. But the final decision, or the final review by a reviewer or so, is something else, and there are other factors that go in that you have no influence on. So I think we got as far as we could get based on our work and our invention. Then the Nobel Committee, of course, made a decision that most people in mass spectrometry actually found very hard to understand. And in fact, I would rather rather than talk about it myself, this is a letter that Peter Rupstorf wrote to the Nobel Committee. He was invited to the ceremony.
So it was chemistry.
It was chemistry.
Okay.
It was chemistry. Oh yes.
And so the Nobel Committee received nominations. Is that not correct?
The Nobel Committee receives nominations. The whole group of the Swedish Royal Academy of Sciences decides early on a general field. So in that year, analytical methods in chemistry were decided field because half of the prize went to for NMR.
Right.
As you may remember. And then there is a small committee of six people or so who really looks into the situation and suggests a list of names to the plenary session of the Royal Academy. So that's the way it goes. So this was sent to the chairman of this eight-person committee or so, Grasslund and some other people. And they, of course, once they narrow their search on a few people, then they ask experts for their opinion. And Peter was one of the ones who was asked, if you can read that from this letter.
see we have something that's left out.
Yeah, yeah, that was purely too confidential, and yeah, we want to share that with you.
Sure.
Which I think is very proper.
Mm-hmm. That's, you know, I agree. So they actually did not go to the 2002 Nobel ceremony?
No, no, they didn't go. And someone, and there is good reason to believe that it was one from the inner circle of the Nobel organization, slipped this letter to the Aftonbladet, the main daily newspaper in Sweden, and this created a huge response all over the world.
Yeah.
And I mean, that didn't give us the Nobel Prize, and €1 million would have been nice to have, or half a million. I don't know. But, well, there's another email I want to show to you. This is from one of my friends at Valmont. It's very short.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can I have these for my file? These
If you want them.
Yeah, sure.
Of course, the Peter's letter is confidential.
Sure, okay.
That should not anywhere appear in public.
Okay. CHF is very sensitive to making sure that material... Nothing that is said here will be... the only people that will know of it are the two of us, the transcriber, the person who actually types it, and they... have no clue.
No, I understand that, but this particular, I don't want.
Yeah, I think for the record, it would be good to have it in the CHF.
Okay, and you can imagine I got tons of emails in that time, and I couldn't answer every one of them separately, so I had a general letter that you can also have in your files.
Very good.
You know, I have known two people who felt that they should have gotten the Nobel Prize and didn't get it,
mm-hmm.
and both of them wound up as alcoholics,
mm-hmm.
and both of them died at a relatively early age.
Mm-hmm.
I lucked out. It didn't really touch me so much. Honestly, I didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
That this would make to the Nobel Prize. Though I must say that afterwards, when I looked at the list of Nobel Prizes, more prizes were awarded to methods
mm-hmm.
than like PCR or the speed method to make peptides
mm-hmm.
and yeah. Then to basic principles.
Yeah.
So it wasn't later on when I thought about it. Before then, I didn't think it was. I didn't expect it.
Yeah.
Later on, I thought if you ask, if you take electrospray and MALDI together, what impact this has on our society. On medicine, on biology, on our understanding of the world,
mm-hmm.
it is It is a significant impact.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they nominated this field was quite okay. Why they gave it to Tanaka, nobody has a clue.
Mm-hmm.
There are theories about it that I don't want to go into. None of them is very pleasant, let's say. I met Grasslund at a conference once,
mm-hmm.
and she made sure she didn't bump into me. Mm-hmm. It was at the summer school, actually,
mm-hmm.
in Croatia. I think it's fair to say it was a wrong decision.
I think so.
We published earlier, by 2 years, the whole principle. It's true. If we would have tried trypsin, let's say, at that time, we surely would have gotten a prospectrum,
mm-hmm.
and that would most probably have done it.
Mm-hmm.
But, that wasn't my approach to science.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in the mechanisms.
Yeah.
And we looked at
that. You were following a logical research agenda to try and understand what was going on. And the whole idea of just kind of waving this big flag like the New York Times guy with
Right. Of course, one reason is that they have never, ever divided the Nobel Prize up among more than three people.
Right.
So that may have been, but, then they should have left it out. You can't pick the wrong one only because he's a single person.
Yeah.
Well,
obviously, as you say, there's a number of instances where people think that they really made a mistake.
Yeah.
And, there's that classic case of the woman astronomer who did all this work.
Yeah, and the DNA, double helix, all the crystallography, which was the basis for Watson and Crick mm-hmm. to think up the structure, I always forget her name.
Yeah.
By the time they got the Nobel Prize, she was already dead. She died of cancer. But, it's...
Those people are known,
yeah.
whether they get the prize or not.
No.
They're known,
right?
Okay.
Right. It didn't bother me all that much, and after a couple of months, it was over,
mm-hmm.
and I went on with my job and enjoyed life.
Yes,
and enjoyed science.
So you've met Tanaka, obviously.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I met him 4 or 5 times at ASAMIS, for example.
Yeah.
We certainly chat with each other then, and when I was at the meeting of the Japanese Math Promise Society a couple of years ago, he invited me to his laboratory. That's when we went to see the Geisha House
mm-hmm.
and had some fun there.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, we are colleagues, we respect each other, we are not friends, but even if the Nobel thing it wouldn't have happened, we would never have been friends because he's a very different character.
Yeah.
He's very introverted.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in the end, I got the better out of it because he went into deep depression afterwards.
Oh, really?
Well, as my colleague from Boston wrote in his email, he knew that the majority of people in mass spectrometry thought he was the wrong man to get it, and to go to conferences and you can't look behind the forehead of people, but it's difficult. It's not a mission.
There's something that has happened, and it's interesting part of reality of the real world, and it's. I think your attitude is a good attitude. I assume Michael Karras's feels.
Well, for him it was worse because he was is much younger, and he still has a much more of a career in front of him. And there, of course, the Nobel Prize would help a lot.
Oh, yeah.
That is certainly true. So it was certainly worse for him, but what can we do? What I at times have been wondering about is whether the committee like the Nobel Committee why don't they have the grandeur to later on admit that I made a mistake?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Huh? It's we all make mistakes.
Oh, yes.
Huh?
Yeah.
And then I told you several things happened in my career where we did something. Sometimes it turns out to be wrong. You know, my hopes for the role of MALDI in DNA or RNA analysis didn't really come true for good reasons. Sometimes we did the right thing for the wrong argument. Why can't a committee like that admit?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was Peter Rupsoff wrote a letter, but several others, like Cassie Costello,
mm-hmm.
who was at that time president of ASMS,
yes.
wrote a letter to the Nobel Committee, as a result of which she had a very difficult time with Catherine Fenselhauer and Bob Cotter.
Yes.
They're the only one that I've had some resentment for, actually. I must admit that, and I'm open about it. The mass spectrometer that the Tanaka group built was built on IP of Bob Cotter.
Mm-hmm.
It has a very special reflector.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a business relationship there. And I don't think that it was proper that the Nobel Prize committee asked them for a review. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just not proper. But Catherine blamed Cassie for writing this letter in the name of ASMS, not having asked everyone else. So, it's gone and over.
Okay.
And,
I think it's something that we, as long as you're comfortable discussing it, I think it's something that should be part of our discussion.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah. No, I'm perfectly at ease.
You'll get a chance to, you know, look through this and decide if you want to strike, you know, anything that you said. That's perfectly fine and up to you.
Anything else?
I think that we've covered most of the topics that I had in mind. I think you've prepared very well for this. There are some issues. I'd like to do a little video, but if you don't mind, could we do that tomorrow morning? Sometime?
Yeah.
Maybe in a different setting.
Should we do that in my office?
Yeah, I think we'd probably do that.
It's a better setting than this.
Sure. It would only take about 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah,
I don't want to take a long
time. No, I can pick you up again.
Okay.
And you said you're leaving town tomorrow already.
Yes. After my talk, stay around for question and answer thing, and then we're going to go ahead and find the least trafficky highway back to Berlin. I don't know which one.
We wanted to look for the VIN, the vent.
Are we done here? I can go ahead and put this guy to bed.
Put that guy to bed and I look for him.